The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Tuesday, July 23rd at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board meeting will be held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, July 24th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force will be meeting at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard Sundays at 1 and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. And if you go to KORCFM.com, you can check and find an archive of all of our news programs that run during these times. And this is Dan Krall in the Southtown studio. I am joined by a Corvallis citizen by the name of Wendy Byrne, and we have been talking through email and met locally regarding what's going on in the city, because that seems to be a passion of Wendy's. Thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be here, Dan. Thanks.
So when did you move to Corvallis?
I moved to Corvallis in June of 1999.
Okay. And have you been following city happenings, or at least city government happenings, since that time? Or maybe was there an event that caught your interest and turns you into someone who follows the city regularly?
You know, for years I didn't pay attention. I didn't pay attention at all. But in 2006, I was riding my bike. I was struck by a vehicle. I was pretty significantly injured, and some of my friends after that injury encouraged me to come to the Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Board and speak to the board. And that sort of propelled me into advocacy, and then it's a long story, which we could go into if we wanted to, but that led me to paying more attention over the years, especially in 2019 when they sunset the Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Board. And there was no voice for the pedestrians and bicyclists that wanted to speak to the city. And that was when I really started paying attention, I would say. It's a catch-22, or it was, with the Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Board, because we fell into a pit of trying to micromanage public works. I think we never really used our voice collectively to advocate policy to council. And at that time, I didn't really understand how the system worked. And looking back at it with hindsight, I could see why people were frustrated, because we weren't talking to council. We were talking to staff. And I think staff found our input useful, but our input was supposed to be going to council, and it's something that maybe could use a deeper dive into understanding, because I think it's created a ripple effect where a lot of people feel unheard, and council has not collectively strongly endorsed a policy that supports biking and walking safety. So I think that's changing. There's reasons to be optimistic that that's changing, but it's not going to change without work. So ongoing attention and work is needed. I don't know. I got a little wandery there, but there's a lot of history there, which I'm fortunate to know a lot of, because I've been around paying attention.
Do you feel like our current city council is receptive to public comments on topics like this, or just any general topic?
They're definitely receptive to it. For if you show up, if you log in, if you watch the video recordings and go to council meetings, they will hear you. But they constantly fall back on asking people to slow down as their primary method of safety. And that goes right into a vacuum. That doesn't do anything. And then city council feels like they've done something by asking the public to slow down in their driving habits, and that's incredibly frustrating, because it does nothing.
They're like too timid to ask people to chill out on the roads?
They're too timid to create the safety we need to see. They say chill out on the roads, but what they really need to do is create a policy that directs public works to build the infrastructure in such a way that forces people to slow down.
Policies, not proclamations.
Amen. Yeah, exactly.
So what is something you would recommend to citizens out there who really want to be involved, but maybe don't have the time to show up to a council meeting, or there's rules of order that some folks may not be aware of, which sometimes folks on the council may get caught up on? And that's another way to kind of push the public out of the discussion.
Right. Yeah, it's really easy to expect that city council can just direct staff to do things, and it doesn't work that way. City council needs to focus on creating the policy, and then if the policies don't get followed, they need to direct their very few employees to do their jobs correctly so that the policies are followed and put into action. And if there are people who are concerned, if they don't have time to go to council meetings, they need to consider writing to their city council members, which is easy to do via email. Those get where they need to go. We have a great system. The city government has a very good email system of tracking stuff, or getting involved with one of the local organizations, such as my group that's called Streets Are for Everyone, Corvallis, that can help people know where, which items are coming up, which items are important, where some more input could be useful to help move the needle on actually creating safety on our roadways.
I believe I've heard of your group. SAFE is the acronym. Is it based here in Corvallis?
It is. There is a SAFE. There is a larger organization called SAFE, Streets Are for Everyone, in Los Angeles. We are not affiliated, and they do not seem unhappy that we are also using a similar name. I think that organization likes anything that anybody has to do to create safety. We picked our name before we knew there was another organization. So Streets Are for Everyone, SAFE, Corvallis. We have a website. We send out action alerts. We are a loosely affiliated group of individuals who haven't yet decided if we're going to incorporate, if we're going to go for nonprofit status. But we are definitely active, and we're being heard. I really respect our public works director for hearing us and giving us time and paying attention.
Aside from pedestrian issues, what are some of the really important issues that you think are facing the city right now?
I think probably the primary issue facing the city right now is housing and lack of adequate housing. And I think there are strong overlaps between transportation issues and housing issues and equity issues, and it's a challenging problem, but it doesn't mean that Corvallis can't move forward and make positive outcomes.
How are people supposed to find somewhere to live if the minimum rent is $1,200 a month, basically to live in a box?
Right. I know I've been alarmed at the rental prices I've seen on places in my neighborhood. Now that it's summertime and there's for rent signs up, I look at the houses and I look at the bedrooms and I'm like, how can somebody afford that for a 3-bedroom? You know, it blows my mind. And yet it's, you know, I think all the options need to be on the table to be discussed. If we need to do rent control, then we need to do rent control.
I just know that from my own personal situation, I'm very fortunate to be in a home that I bought in 2007 before it was unrealistic. And I actually made way less money then than I do as a self-employed person, and not to mention the huge salary I make at KORC, this monthly stipend. It's huge. But I feel like if something were to happen, if I were to lose my house, I do not feel I'd be able to get into a housing situation very easily without having to, well, hope for the mercy of some good roommates. I know I'm not the easiest person to live with, and I think of a lot of folks who are unhoused. It could just be a little detail like, you know, they make enough money or whatever. They just didn't have a stable enough job, even if they had enough money in the bank, or they just didn't work out with their partner, their love partner, or a roommate, and it's so easy to become unhoused in this country today.
Right. And, you know, we used to talk about this maybe 5 or 6 years ago. There used to be more discussion about how medical debt launches people into houselessness. I think it's compounded. I mean, I think there are lots of people, you know, you are just one injury or one crash or one misstep away from medical bills that you can't recover from, and that's a major problem, which it has definitely been better for a lot of people with the Affordable Care Act, but that might go away. That might change. There's no guarantee that that's going to stay the same. And so it's, yeah, right. There's a lot of reason to be anxious about keeping the roofs over our heads for people.
Yeah. And the thing with healthcare, they actually did a study where it was all about the impact of language. And long story short, we Americans have been conditioned to be more comfortable with paying premiums than taxes. So for some reason, we're more comfortable with paying a health insurance company crazy premiums, even though they might deny our benefits or make it hard to get full compensation. But oh, socialized medicine, let's forget that.
Right. I probably shouldn't get started talking about insurance, talking about how that just makes a bunch of rich people are richer and really doesn't do much for the common person. And yet, if you ask people to pay into a government-controlled system, they freak out. Historically speaking, if we need to make sure that our government-run systems are run better and more efficiently, let's deal with that. Let's stop letting healthcare be something that people make money from. Healthcare should be a right. It should be something that we all cover for each other. We would all be better off with a single payer system.
Absolutely. And privatized healthcare, that's just a recipe for disaster, because if it's in the company's best interest to not cover you and to collect more money from you, well, we've already seen how that's turned out. And some of us who maybe haven't been on the planet as long, some of our younger listeners, this is a fight that many people have been trying for decades now, universal healthcare, and it really shouldn't be a divisive point. We would all benefit from a system that does look out for us more. And I think that the lack of civics being taught in schools and just kind of this great lie we've been sold that we're these individualistic Daniel Boones out on the range. Well, what happens when all these Daniel Boones run into one another? I think we've got to figure out a better cooperative system, and we have a lot of bad influences going around. Thanks for joining us today on KORC News, Music, and Civics. We are hearing an interview with Wendy Byrne, a resident of Corvallis, who follows the city council and city government happenings, among other transportation issues and other civics-related content that we hope to feature on future editions of KORC News, Music, and Civics. We'll hear the second half of this interview in just a few minutes.
Donald Trump's self-proclaimed Secretary of Retribution is touting a wild plan to arrest politicians, police officers, and journalists he views as disloyal to the former president, according to a sweeping new investigation by Raw Story. Conservative political activist Ivan Raiklin claims to have assembled a deep state target list that includes high-ranking Democrats and Republicans, U.S. Capitol police officers, officials at the FBI and other intelligence agencies, witnesses in Trump's impeachment trials, and journalists at the New York Times, CNN, The Washington Post, and other news outlets. Their supposed crime? Being Trump's political enemies. And Raiklin views himself as justice incarnate. He intends to enlist right-wing sheriffs to carry out mass arrests, and in May, he declared his intention to arrange live-stream swatting raids. Raiklin reportedly claims that if he went public with all the so-called evidence he collected on Trump's enemies in the deep state, it would be probable cause to arrest those high-ranking officials and journalists on his list. Those arrests would be carried out by constitutional sheriffs, specifically a right-wing anti-government group called the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. Those sheriffs would then deputize the 75,000 veterans Raiklin claims were dismissed from the military for refusing to comply with COVID-19 vaccine mandates, forming a rogue army intent on revenge. Thus far, attempts at assembling his troops have proved less than successful. Raiklin attempted to recruit some of the group's convention at the group's convention in April, where he asked a panel whether they'd be willing to go to the maximum level to create consequences for those federal actors who he alleged had committed some kind of seditious conspiracy. The response was underwhelming, according to Raw Story. Despite being fairly sympathetic to Raiklin, officers warned that his plot was illegal and it would be unlikely that prosecutors would ever press charges. Even Sheriff Dar Leaf, who gained notoriety among the far right for suggesting that the group that attempted to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer was simply attempting to make a citizen's arrest, felt that Raiklin's plan went too far. "We're not going to be able to just go out and arrest," Leaf said. "We've got to do grand jury indictments, just like the Constitution says." The Constitution, imagine. When asked by Raw Story about Raiklin's plan, Leaf said he didn't know who Raiklin was and opposed political prosecutions. Former Sheriff Richard Mack, who leads the Constitutional Sheriff's Group, told Raw Story he had severed ties with Raiklin in early June and did not approve of his rhetoric. Quite frankly, he talks about that list of 350 people. "I'm sure they can afford lawyers," said Mack. "It reeks of lawsuits and it doesn't follow due process." Raiklin has also emailed sheriff's offices across the country hoping to enlist them to his cause. No one has signed on, according to Raw Story. Well, that's pretty raw. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. Up next, it's part two of my interview with Wendy Byrne from earlier this past week. She is a citizen of Corvallis who is keyed into what is happening with city government as well as state issues. And I had a chance to speak with her at the Southtown studio. Here's part two of that interview.
I used to really pay attention to the transportation issues, and then somewhere over the last year, something clicked in my brain that that our housing woes are directly connected to our transportation woes, and we aren't spending our communal dollars on things that are really nurturing for all of us. We tend to spend our communal dollars on things that make it easier for people who have power and thus clout to get around and to live. And so we pave nice big fat roads up to the hills for nice big fat houses. And then we try to take a small percentage of the money that we got to do those projects and say we're going to do it to create a bus line somewhere or create some low-income housing somewhere, and then we say we don't have enough money left to put in a bike lane or actually make a bus run on that transit route very frequently, and then we just say, oh well, I guess we ran out, we'll see what we can do next year, and then we start the whole process over again. And I think some of that's changing. The state is trying, the governor and the last two governors have decided that it's not working, and they need to do something differently, and boy, are they catching flack for that. But we are getting some attention paid to climate, some attention paid to what they call climate-friendly areas. We're dealing with our parking issues. We're restructuring how we handle parking so that we can potentially, we being the state and then the cities, so that we could have less on-street parking and less land covered up with parking lots so we can have better housing. And the ripple effect from that should be tangible, but it's going to take time. And I feel like all these people living out, they don't have time. They don't have that time. And so it's something that really is in the back of my mind all the time now to try and help.
When you see just how bad the unhoused problem in this city has gotten in just the last few years, you can't ignore it. you have to realize that there's some correlation, causation that we really need to think about. It is multifactored.
I feel like that just makes me think, you know, there have been a lot of interesting things that have been happening at the state level that have rippled down to the regional level and the city level, whether it has to do with climate-friendly areas, housing issues, transportation issues, that are happening that people don't know about. And I feel like since I am paying attention and I see about these meetings, I follow them, I watch them. They're all recorded, so if you don't catch them live, you can catch them on Vimeo. And you can start to understand what's going on, and that I would like to share those things with the community so that people know where to get connected. Because I talk to my friends, they say, how do you know all this stuff? And I say, well, it's all there. You just have to look for it. But since I already know, why should my friends recreate the wheel and learn? They if I can get them the information more easily, if I can get the information out into the community, then there will be more power, because I believe that the people in Corvallis are compassionate, people are thoughtful, and I want to amplify those voices, I guess.
We at KORC would like to amplify those voices as well. We are joined by Wendy Byrne, who is a citizen of Corvallis since June of 1999 and is keyed in with a lot of what is happening with the city government, city council, and I'm hoping that we will hear more of Wendy Byrne on this very program, KORC News, Music, and Civics, and also archived online, and maybe hear some of your reports on the city council or state budget meetings that you've attended, because it sounds like you can digest that information in a way that is relatable to others in the community who may not have the time or the mental bandwidth to follow all of that.
Right. It's you know, these days, it feels like everybody's going full tilt all day long, and at the end of the day, who wants to spend time sitting in front of the computer trying to figure out what city meetings to watch? So since I do that quite frequently for fun, I can distill that down for people and help them understand it.
And you were wanting to do a podcast, right? Isn't that kind of your idea recently, that you and a friend of yours were going to do a podcast about city politics?
You know, we've kicked around the idea. I think we're both a little concerned about the time commitment that might bring, but at the same time, we both have a lot of information we'd like to share, and I think it would be a good challenge, personal challenge, and an interesting way to get information out to people. So that's definitely, there's potential there.
Well, I would absolutely welcome you and your recording partner to share your findings and your thoughts on KORC. We are the local community radio. I can't tell you how many people are listening. I assume we do have thousands of listeners, but that's a guess. I mean, our online listenership at KORCFM.com is always growing. Our analytics are very impressive, actually, for this just people streaming on the internet. But I do know that folks locally are listening in on 105.9 FM, and it would be really cool to get some more insight. Like I was telling you off mic, the radio station is run by those who show up. And I would personally, as the station manager, love to see more coverage of local politics than the city government within our news program. And of course, our news program is open to all sorts of interviews, human interest stories, and folks out there listening, if you would like to contribute a story or help us out, info@korcfm.com is the email that you can reach us through. And again, Wendy Byrne of Corvallis, I'd like to thank you for your time today, and we certainly look forward to what you have in store for us, perhaps.
Yeah, you're welcome, Dan. I look forward to being here. Thanks.
And if folks want to learn more about SAFE, which again stands for?
Streets Are For Everyone Corvallis.
What is the website?
www.safecorvallis.org.
All right. Thanks again for your time.
You're welcome, and thank you.
This is Alex Huff. I'm a DJ for KORC, and I am from a small town about 40 minutes southeast of Corvallis named Brownsville. Brownsville is known by many as the Stand By Me town. It's one of several towns since the 1980s that has had the honor of representing Stephen King's iconic Castle Rock on the silver screen. Stand By Me was released in 1986 and takes place in 1959. It follows a two-day journey of four preteen friends, Gordon, Chris, Teddy, and Vern, who are trying to locate the body of a missing boy their age named Ray Brower. It's a bit dark, but also very funny and deeply touching. The boys are played by Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, and Jerry O'Connell, all of whom went on to have successful careers.
We talked into the night. The kind of talk that seemed important until you discover girls.
All right. Mickey's a mouse, Donald's a duck, Pluto's a dog. What's Goofy? If I can only have one food for the rest of my life, that's easy. Pez. Cherry flavored Pez. No question about it.
Goofy's a dog. He's definitely a dog.
I knew the $64,000 question was fixed. There's no way anybody can know that much about opera. He can't be a dog. He wears a hat and drives a car. Wagon Train's a really cool show, but did you ever notice that they never get anywhere? They just keep wagon training. God, that's weird. What the hell is Goofy?
Not one of us mentioned Ray Brower, but we were all thinking about him.
I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say it's remained one of the most loved films of all time. And Brownsville can prove it by the hundreds, and some years even thousands, of people from all over the world who come out to celebrate Stand By Me Day. While the film takes place over Labor Day weekend, Stand By Me Day happens every July 23rd. Brownsville was selected as a shooting location thanks to its 1950s ambiance, which remains largely the same to this day and really adds to the charm of this event, which began in 2007 and includes shooting location tours, character impersonators, and of course a pie-eating contest. For those who have seen the film, you already know that the pie-eating scene is among the most memorable.
Suddenly, Bardess opened his mouth. And before Bill Travis knew it, he was covered with five pies worth of used blueberries. The women in the audience screamed. Boss man Bob Cormier took one look at Bill Travis and barfed on Principal Wiggins. Principal Wiggins barfed on the lumberjack that was sitting next to him. Mayor Grundy barfed on his wife's tits. But when the smell hit the crowd, that's when Lardass' plan really started to work. Girlfriends barfed on boyfriends. Kids barfed on their parents. A fat lady barfed in her purse. The Donnelly twins barfed on each other. And the women's auxiliary barfed all over the benevolent order of antelopes. And Lardass just sat back and enjoyed what he created.
And speaking of creating things, I sat down with Stand By Me Day's event chair, Linda McCormick, at the Pioneer Picture Gallery in downtown Brownsville, just mere feet from the commemorative penny that is fused to the crosswalk as a nod to the scene where Vern excitedly finds a penny in the road. We immediately jumped into what to look forward to this year, as well as some of the highs and lows of keeping an event like this alive.
We have a penny embedded here where Vern stopped, and with that many fans, they stopped traffic.
I've heard about the controversial penny in the road.
Yeah, because they want their picture with it, and then more people come. And it's farming season, so we had big tractors going through yesterday that I was behind. So we actually have two guys that are going to take turns being crossing guards.
Oh, good.
And so they'll, you know, let traffic go, and then, okay, come on out. So it's just sort of hilarious that in this little teeny town we have to find crossing guards, you know, but that's what it's about.
On the subject of fundraising, so like the marathon, we haven't had that every year because that takes a certain amount of fundraising. And then also showing the movie hasn't happened every year because of fundraising issues. Talk a little bit about that, because for an event so relatively successful, I know it's not, you know, Oregon Country Fair or anything, but it's pretty big for this town. I'm surprised that there isn't more funding.
Well, and that's the thing, because for every event in this town, we go begging.
Right.
You know, so most of them are pretty limited. We've had pretty good luck for the most part. I think this time, like, our hours are from 11 to 5, And we can't start the movie till like 9, 9:30, quarter to 10. So it's in the dark, you know, in the park. And again, you have to pay for copyright. That's, last time it was about $300, mm-hmm. just to say it's legal. And then you need to find someone who has a big enough screen and the projector that'll, you know, work. So it's a fairly expensive thing to do. But we've renovated the rec center up here that's behind City Hall, and it's got a huge gym. And one of the things they want is a screen, because they have other uses for a screen. So I'm hoping next year that maybe we can do that, and we can show it ourselves with our own equipment, our own screen, and then we just need the money to get the copyright permission.
Right, and you could, you're not limited to after 9.
And exactly, you can play it any time of the day. So, and the Oregon Film Office has now created the Oregon Film Trail. They're building and building and building. I think Stand By Me was the first one on that, and you can go all over the state. We've got 3 signs where scenes were shot here in Brownsville, and one is in the park. They also work with a phone app called Set Jetters. You can put it on your phone, and anywhere in the world, you can open that app and say, is there a movie that was filmed near me, or how close, where was the nearest movie filmed? And they've got all kinds of information. You can take a picture, set it up on your camera, and it'll put you in a scene.
Oh, wow.
Through the camera, with you standing at that location or
that's incredible.
Like that. So, and we also have family games. We've got hula hoops, jacks, so.
Things that feel very 50s.
Yeah. And Caesar the No Drama Llama is decided to come and join us. The blueberry pie eating contest.
That'll take
3.
3, yep.
Yep, I think we're starting sign-ups at 1 o'clock at our information booth. That'll be on the deck at Randy's Main Street Coffee. Okay. At 3. And the Central Lynn Lions Club is putting that on.
Oh, okay.
And our local Pioneer Villa restaurant.
Oh, they're providing the pies?
They're providing the pies.
Oh, they have good pies, too.
I know. They're really good.
These are not cheap pies. These are good pies.
For smearing them all over your face, they're really good pies. Exactly. And then we have a pie booth. We're getting them from a Mennonite woman who makes wonderful blueberry pies.
Or you can just buy one.
So you can buy a slice. You don't have to put your face in it. And then we have the guy that has a tractor, and he churns ice cream with the engine. He'll be there to put ice cream on your pie. We've got a couple of food trucks. One food truck is hoping to make something, we call it a Verno burger. So it's like hamburger in the shape of a hot dog.
Oh, funny.
So, and we've got a 50-50 raffle we're going to be doing. So about 4 o'clock, I think we'll pull the ticket for that. We've got guided walking tours all day long. We've got a choir that's kind of gathered, and they've learned some of the songs and other 50s-ish
songs.
Oh, great. So they'll be wandering around town singing.
Because it's an iconic soundtrack.
It really is. And like I said, the food trucks, and we're hoping to get a number of old cars. When Gordy comes out the door of the store with his magazine, there's a brown pickup truck. And it still runs, and it lives here in Brownsville.
Oh, wow.
And so he's going to try to park it about where it was in the movie. I think where exactly it was is illegal right now. So he's going to get as close as he can. He has a picture from the film in his window, so people can stand out there, take a picture in front of the truck. A couple others we know of that I think are going to try to be here that were just in the film somewhere. You know, the fans love just those little tidbits.
Totally.
You know? Yeah.
Tell me more about this raffle. It's going to take place in front of the museum.
Yeah, so last year we had a lady who put together 4 boys and dressed them as close to looking like the boys in the movie.
Right.
And so they're going to try to do that again this year. So they'll be selling the raffle tickets around town and taking pictures with you with the 4 boys.
That's fun.
And then I think we'll have one of them draw the winning ticket for the 50-50 raffle.
And what do you get for that? What is
money.
Just money.
However much. Last year it was about $200.
Wow.
So we split it in half. We get half and you get half. The winner, the winning ticket, gets half of the money we pulled.
Wow.
So.
And our I'm wearing a Stand By Me shirt. I got this at the museum here. This was for the 30th anniversary,
though.
There you go. Are there new shirts, different shirts, or just these same ones from the
30th? We've got some different ones. I think the same ones we had last year and maybe the year before. The company that we got your shirt from, because it's a picture of Vern, and
it says,
it's a picture out of the movie.
Yep. We found want to see a dead body?
Do you want to see a dead body?
You guys want to go see a dead body?
We all understood what Vern meant right away.
The company we got that from, they had copyright permission to use scenes on their t-shirt. So we got two or three different ones, and they no longer are doing that.
Okay.
So we've had to do our own artwork.
There is a lot that goes into these small events that are big deal things. The copyright, the rights to even make a fun t-shirt. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't realize how difficult it is to be above board and to put on
to
an event like this.
Right. Well, and we've joked, you know, we're keeping that movie alive. You know, they should be paying us.
Right, yeah, you should be giving something, a medal or something.
Not the way it works. I just ordered, in fact, a bunch of dog tags because Teddy had
his
dog tag.
Dog
so we have a dog tag, and it says Stand By Me Day, Brownsville, Oregon.
That's neat.
We've got combs that we've done.
Oh, Vern's combs.
You know, it's corny, but they love it. So
yeah, it's a very simple film, which is part of its beauty. And so you do remember all those little details of each character, the things they like, and you know, there's only so many towns that have gotten to be a Castle Rock in cinema, and we're one of them.
Right. I tell people my defining moment for why am I doing this. Years ago, I had a guy here from Australia, and I was walking around showing him where some of the scenes were shot. And there's one where Gordy and Chris are walking downtown, and there's like an overhang with a post, you know, a cover over the sidewalk. And this guy went up and he put his hand on the post, and he just said, "I've waited a long time to touch this post."
Wow.
And I'm like, really? So it's not just recognizing things, but, and I've talked to some, and they feel like they are now part of the movie when they've been here. It's just not their favorite movie, but they're now a part of it, and it's touched their heart, touched their soul. I don't know. So when people say, "Why are you still doing this?" When you see the faces, you have fulfilled someone's dream. That's what keeps driving me, and seeing those smiles.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for keeping that magic in this town. It's always been magical growing up here and knowing it's the Stand By Me town. It's how other people from other towns refer to us.
Yep, Castle Rock.
And we've really fully embraced that. And not every town with a shooting location does that. So thank you for your effort.
You're welcome.
And everyone, show up on the 23rd, July 23rd every year. And we've got some great events this year, so be sure to give the movie another watch if you need a refresher, or if you've never seen it, definitely you can rent it digitally. That's what I did last night. Come on out to Brownsville, Oregon.
That was Linda McCormick of Brownsville, event chair for Stand By Me Day, which takes place on July 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. I'm Alex Huff for KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Tuesday, July 23rd at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board meeting will be held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, July 24th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force will be meeting at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. In 2020, Oregon voters passed Measure 109, which directed the Oregon Health Authority to license and regulate the manufacturing, transportation, delivery, sale, and purchase of psilocybin products and the provision of psilocybin services. This allowed for the creation of psilocybin service centers, where people can legally ingest the potent chemical while under the watch of trained, licensed facilitators. with current research showing promising results for psilocybin's potential to treat mental health challenges such as PTSD and depression, the passing of Measure 109 was significant. And so it most likely was in the mind of Heather Thomas, one of the co-founders of Corvallis's first psilocybin service centers. Named Unstuck LLC for the ability of the drug to help the mind get out of stuck patterns of thought, it opened its doors to the public this past spring. I had the opportunity to sit down in one of the rooms where the sessions occur with Heather to discuss Unstuck and other matters surrounding psilocybin. Let's take a listen.
I'd like to begin by asking, what is the story behind Unstuck?
Well, I have been working in healthcare for over 20 years and have become increasingly frustrated with the healthcare system, in particular, how we're addressing mental health in this country. You know, if you look at things like cardiac care, joint care, we've made incredible progress in healthcare. But when it comes to mental health, we really haven't. But if you start taking a look at the research behind psilocybin, it's incredible what an impact psilocybin can make. And so in my own life, I had experienced several traumatic accidents. And it was through psilocybin that I was able to come out on the other side and be able to engage in my normal everyday activities. For example, I was in two really bad skiing accidents. I was able to get back to skiing. I was in a really bad cycling accident. I was able to get back to cycling. And I think these are, you know, activities that I was able to get back to, not just because of psilocybin, I also had a great therapist as well, but I think talk therapy takes you to a certain point and then you need something else. And for me and for many people, psilocybin is that thing. And so, you know, when I heard that Oregon was the first state in the nation to make it legal, I got really excited about, wow, can I take my experience in healthcare, and I have a doctorate degree in healthcare administration, can I take all of that and actually help people? Can I, you know, open this up to others and help others have that same experience that I did? And so started looking into the Oregon Health Authority regulations and just started on that process. I felt very, very driven to again open up something here in Corvallis and make it accessible to people here in Corvallis and the surrounding areas. So myself and my partner, he is very business-minded, and I'm grateful for that because I am not necessarily business-minded. We also paired up with another person who's in healthcare, and so the three of us have gotten to where we're at now, where we were able to sign a lease here in February, and then we became fully licensed in April. So we opened up here in April as a fully licensed psilocybin treatment center. Mm.
Could you describe what a session is like?
Yeah, for sure. A session for each person is going to be very unique and very different. Mm. So I can't tell you this is exactly what you're going to experience. But when a client comes in, you know, first thing the facilitator does is brings them to one of the rooms, gets them comfortable, and then helps them consume the psilocybin in a form that's comfortable for them. The most common form is through a tea, which requires grinding up the psilocybin, and which all the psilocybin is actually, Oregon Health Authority requires us to get psilocybin from a licensed manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So it's been lab tested. We know exactly how much psilocybin is in it, mm-hmm. right? So they grind that up, they can put it in a tea, and what's wonderful about the tea is I don't think we've had one client who said they've had an upset stomach or felt nausea, right? It's really nice on the stomach, absorbs into the system quickly, and it's a really nice ritual to sit in and make the tea. You could also grind it up and put in applesauce or peanut butter, or you could eat it raw if you want to, which is not very pleasant. Very bitter, but it's up to the client. And so the facilitator will guide the client through activities that might help them get into their body and relax, set intention for the experience. Mm-hmm. With a little asterisk on that, is setting intention is that, you know, the client can set an intention, but you need to be open to what the psilocybin and what the mushrooms really have intended for you, right? And so for me, one of the more recent experiences that I had is I had a friend who recently passed away. Mm-hmm. And I went in with the intention of, I really want to grieve and let this go. And I had a very different experience. That was not what was intended for me. That's not what my nervous system, what my brain needed for that experience. And I ended up having an experience of incredible gratitude. I had an experience of really opening up to my connection to others in the world. And so, yeah, we can go into with it an intention, but you might get something very different. It's what you need, not necessarily what you want. Mm-hmm. And so when the psilocybin starts to kick in, we encourage the client to put on an eye mask and headphones. And the reason behind that is the research says that to get the most out of the psilocybin experience, you need to focus inward, not outward. Mm-hmm. And so while our space is very relaxing and calming and professional, we really want you to focus inward. Eye mask, headphones allows you to focus inward. And so our clients typically have that eye mask on and the headphones on for the entire journey or experience, which is typically 4 to 6 hours. So during that time, if they need to get up and go to the bathroom, the facilitator is there. The facilitator is to help guide them through and get the most out of their experience. So the facilitator is with them to provide whatever assistance and guidance is needed during that time. Towards the end of the experience, if the client wants to talk through, the facilitator is there. One of the things that we do here is we provide all of our clients a journal. And that journal is going to go home with them. But what the facilitator does is they can write down anything the client says during their journey. And that might help them through the integration process of putting it all together. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, taking a look at what were some of the key things that the client said or brought up. I know that during some of my journeys, I've like taken notes for a client up to 10 pages of just how much they're taking. Sometimes a client won't say anything, and that's okay. But we give the client some prompts and some things to process once they go home. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the experience of that day, after the end of the 4 to 6 hours, they need to have someone come and pick them up, because they are still going to continue to feel the effects of the psilocybin. Perceptually, they're going to be impaired. So we ask that they be driven home. And then we follow up within 72 hours and schedule an integration session. And it's during the integration session that I say that's when the real magic happens. Because during the session, when you're here under the influence of psilocybin, you're opening up new neural pathways, right? Well, your brain continues to be open for weeks, potentially months after that, right? And so it's really important to integrate and continue to integrate and learn what was that journey about and what was that experience about and how is my brain expanding and what are some ways I can change my life and get unstuck. And so that's kind of like the whole process of the administration session. And you kind of ask like what happens to the client during the administration session. Mm-hmm. Your perception is going to be altered, meaning vision, hearing, even taste is enhanced. But what each person experiences is very unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can imagine. It just depends on the individual's makeup. Mm-hmm. And their particular journey they're on. Mm-hmm. This leads me into a similar question. What kinds of safeguards do you have in place, you know, just in case there's a negative reaction to the psilocybin? You know, I'm just curious about that.
Well, we kind of have the perspective there's no such thing as necessarily a negative, but it might be a challenging experience that a client might be going through. And we've all been trained to how to handle those challenging experiences, and we're also very prepared for that, right? So we always have a second person here in case we need help for any reason, right? Whether or not we need water or food or we need to call a support person. You'll notice in each of our rooms, we actually have a little safety button here on the wall. Yeah. And so that means we never have to leave the room to call the extra person. All of us are have worked in healthcare, which is really nice. So we have healthcare background. So if there's ever, you know, something related to health, that we're ready to prepared to deal with that. But we also have some techniques. So if a client is really, really challenged emotionally, there are some grounding techniques that we can use to help ground them into some sensory input that will actually help bring them back into their bodies, into the present. Because it's common that a client might travel back in time or travel to a different space or, a completely different place than where their body is. And so we often will let a client embrace and surrender to some of those challenges because it's often what they need. And that reminding them that it's temporary, right? It's temporary. Go through, surrender, breathe, and some breathing techniques. And it's really beautiful when they can go through that and come out on the other side and see, wow, oh my gosh, yeah, I went through that. And I went through that and I evolved and I grew from that. There's a lot of different techniques that we can use when a client's experiencing something challenging. One of those things too is also therapeutic touch. You know, we before the client comes in, we talk about what might be calming to you. Is it holding your hand? Is it a hand on your shoulder? Oregon Health Authority only allows us to provide therapeutic touch in certain ways, mm-hmm. a hug, hands on hands, hands on feet. So we talk to a client. Sometimes for a client, it's no touch, right? Like, and during the journey, they can choose to say, look, even though ahead of time I said I want you to hold my hand if I'm in a challenging situation, they could say, nope, no hands right here, right? And so they have that ability to choose what's going to be most comforting. We also have lots of other things that could be very comforting. We have lots of fuzzy blankets. We have a heater. We have cool things that, so we use a lot of sensory strategies that can be very comforting in a challenging situation. Mm. And that goes back to a lot of our training and extra training that we've all done to help with those extra challenging situations that a client might experience. Yeah.
Sure. I also wonder about the potential risks of psilocybin potentially opening up some sort of latent mental health issues. I'm curious if there are protocols in place for that, you know, if you have any sort of relationship with mental health professionals, you know, and so I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Oregon Health Authority does require us to do a pretty thorough screening before we work with the client. And so if they are actively psychotic, if they're actively suicidal, we need to refer them to a mental health professional and this is not the right time for psilocybin. And so we need to screen for psychosis. There is limited research about that, about whether or not that could bring on psychosis, but we don't want to take that chance, right? So we want to be extra careful. We want to make sure that they are really prepared. So we spend time in the preparation session. Maybe it means delaying that administration session till that they're, because, you know, there's research about set and setting. Setting is like this beautiful space, and which is, you know, set and setting has a huge influence on how challenging a journey or how therapeutic a journey can be, right? Which is why you hear these experiences of people saying they had a bad trip because they were out at a festival and they consumed a bunch of mushrooms and who knows was it the mushroom, but the setting wasn't right, but also their mindset, right? So if somebody is already really, really struggling with things, maybe they're fighting with their spouse, they're surrounded by a lot of challenging things, maybe we need to wait and help them work through so that they're at a space where they can have a better mindset when they first come in. And so that is part of the preparatory session. So our services include three steps, right? Preparatory, administration, integration. And so during that preparatory session, we really want to make sure, are they fully ready? Do they meet all the requirements by OHA in regards to mental health and psychosis and things like that? And then also, too, to answer your question, if afterwards they are now, maybe they peeled the onion away a little bit and they're realizing, oh, wow, I have some things I really need to deal with. We have a list of mental health practitioners in the area that we're referring to that are psilocybin aware, meaning they understand the research behind psilocybin, they understand the process of psilocybin, so that we can refer our clients to those resources. Oftentimes, if we have a client come in and they've been struggling with mental health, sometimes we'll refer that they get connected to a mental health practitioner even prior to the administration session. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, not everyone needs to see a mental health provider afterwards. We do have We have someone who is leading groups for integration sessions continuously after their administration session. And so that is a great resource as well. So they don't necessarily have to see an individual mental health practitioner. They can go to our groups.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would like to know, if you don't mind opening up a little more, what your experience with psilocybin is like. If you can expand on that a bit, you know, you don't have to get, you know, obviously you don't have to give away too many details, but you've been through this experience, I guess just maybe expand a little more on what that was like so people have an idea. Of.
Sure. Okay, so I will explain my experience with a little asterisk. And what I mean by that is, don't go into a psilocybin experience expecting to be like someone else's, right? So I don't know if you've ever read Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. Mm-hmm. Highly, highly recommend it. But he even speaks to this, right? That we go into a psilocybin experience with these preconceived notions that it's going to be like what we've seen on TV or what we've heard about. So, for example, if I said, oh, you're going to see tropical trees, we as humans were highly suggestible. And so now if I was to give you psilocybin, you might see tropical trees, right? Mm-hmm. So I will explain my psilocybin journey with a little asterisk to say everybody's experience is so different.
Sure.
We use here, in most service centers, use curated music that is specially designed for psilocybin journeys. And my journeys are often very linked to the music, right? And it's beautiful. I will explain kind of a little bit about one of the more significant journeys that I had, where I really went back and explored. I'm recently divorced, and so I actually went back and really explored some things about my marriage. And I was actually there. I really felt like I was there with my ex-husband. And what was beautiful about the experience is that I was re-experiencing some of the positive parts of the marriage. It was so detailed to the point of, like, I felt him, I could smell his hair, I could feel his shirt. It's a wonderful mix of experiences with him, of my past. There's definitely some parts of my experiences that are hard to articulate, mm-hmm. hard to put to words, that were more related to feeling. Definitely, you know, seeing lots of pretty colors and feeling the music. And emotion, lots of emotion. And emotion would range, right? So again, from just feeling the grief and feeling deep, deep in my body, just the pain of that divorce and that pain of the loss of that relationship, and just being with that feeling and almost tangible within my body, and crying and just letting it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to do that. Yeah. I needed to let that go. I needed to just sob and cry. And it was so cathartic. It was almost like the tears were just that emotion and just letting it all go.
Mm.
And I'm so grateful for my facilitator of letting me cry and not rushing in to say, or, you know, that's a good facilitator does that, mm-hmm. and lets you process and letting you go through that. And yeah, it was hard, but oh my God, it felt so great afterwards, you know? And then I just had this feeling of elation and this just incredible feeling of gratitude. And I had an incredible, just an incredible feeling of gratitude to the people that have influenced where I'm at now. Mm-hmm. I had a moment of incredible gratitude to my father. Mm-hmm. And crying about that, but it, being happy about it, like the feeling of gratitude and crying about it, and just this, oh. And yeah, and what's incredible though is a few weeks ago, my parents actually flew up here from California and have both had a psilocybin experience. Oh, wow. And my father's 85 years old. And like, that's amazing. That's amazing to me. That yeah. is just so, so cool. So it is hard to articulate and put into words a psilocybin experience. All I can say is it's an emotional ride, right? Mm-hmm. And it's an emotional ride. And if you surrender to that emotional ride, I think the things that have challenged me the most in a psilocybin experience are the ones that I gain the most from.
Sure, sure. Well, thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah.
I know that psilocybin experiences are profoundly personal experiences. You know, you mentioned you can't really articulate your experience because it's very individualistic. You know, you understand how you work, mm-hmm. and only you. And so the way things connect, the way things shift, you get it, though you couldn't, you know, though it's difficult to describe to another person. Yeah, well, I appreciate you sharing that story, and I would like to just open up to if you have any last comments or anything you'd like to say to close this out.
I would really encourage everyone to think about psilocybin. You don't have to be depressed. You don't have to have PTSD, anxiety. It can really help anybody get unstuck. You know, I think psilocybin has had a lot of bad press in the past, especially if you grew up in the war against drugs era. Consider looking at the research around psilocybin. Consider looking at, you know, coming to a space like this that is safe, that is professional. You know, one of the things that we really was important to us when we opened the center is that it was a very professional space that felt safe for anyone, even someone who is 85 years old and grew up, you know, and was part of that war against drugs, that you know, they would feel comfortable experiencing psilocybin for the first time, mm-hmm. and getting so much out of it. And so I'm very grateful to the community of Corvallis for welcoming us with open arms and helping us through this process, mm-hmm. and helping to spread the word about the incredible benefits of psilocybin.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time, Heather.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Heather Thomas with Unstuck LLC. More information can be found at unstuckoregon.com. This is KORC.